Okay, good morning, everybody. Nice to see everybody. I will just 10 seconds, without obviously entering any level of a political arena, but just a opening with a tefillah that Be'ezrat Hashem, Kadosh Baruch Hu, should give us the guidance and the ability to reunite in everything. All the craziness in either direction should Be'ezrat Hashem calm down. And especially as we enter this time before Tisha B'Av, we should find ways to unite with each other more than anything else. Okay, so what I wanted to talk about today was to take a little bit of a break from our Parshat HaShavua and actually talk a little bit about Tisha B'Av. We've done that in past years. In past years, we've had a few classes on Tisha B'Av. This time, we'll have just one class on Tisha B'Av. But what I find personally a little bit challenging about Tisha B'Av is that it's a hard day to relate to. No one likes to be sad. Generally, it's not something we like. And at the same time, it's also obviously an incredibly important day in our history. And I think that sometimes people just try and kind of find a way to like just pass the time. How do I, you know, I deal with the fasting and then I just sit there and just kind of find ways to keep ourselves busy. And I think that that's unfortunate because we have to recognize that Tisha B'Av is part of a cycle of the entire year. And just like we celebrate the high moments, we're also meant to commemorate and to mourn the challenging moments. That's part of the entire cycle of the year and part of the cycle of our lives. And I think that it's important to prepare for Tisha B'Av just like we prepare for other Chagim. Other Chagim, we listen to classes or we go over different texts in order to prepare for the Chag. And that is what enhances our Chag. The same thing should be done appropriately on Tisha B'Av, and sometimes it's avoided. And so what I wanted to do today is hopefully learn with you a new idea that I kind of developed myself, meaning that I kind of came upon over the last few days, that I hope will lend more meaning to our experience on Tisha B'Av. And the question that I started out with is the following. Every meaningful day in the Jewish year has some kind of way that we're meant to express it. Meaning, what is, I think in more yeshivish terms, there's a mitzvah hayom. There's a mitzvah of the day. Okay, so every chag has something, you know, whether it's Rosh Hashanah, there are certain ways that we associate Rosh Hashanah, and there are certain ways that we associate Sukkot, Chanukah, Purim, Pesach, Shavuot is always a question because there's more minhagim and less mitzvot. What is the mitzvah hayom? Now, obviously, Tisha B'Av is not a chag, but it's a day of importance. It's a day of commemoration. It's a day that we're meant to be focusing on something. So what are we meant to do? What is the mitzvah hayom? What is the action of the day on Tisha B'Av? And that's what I wanted to explore today. And I think that if we take a look, if we explore from the very, very beginning, the history of Tisha B'Av, all the way down to the way that we're meant to observe it today, that there's certain halachot that exist today, we see one theme. And that theme is, what I wrote here, Tisha B'Av, a day of tears. That Tisha B'Av, at its core, from its very, very beginning, the theme that comes out is one of crying, of bechi, of tears. And that is a theme that repeats itself repeatedly throughout a number of different aspects to the day of Tisha B'Av. And I think that's what we should be focusing on. The day should be one where we endeavor, not always successfully, it's not easy to attach ourselves and to understand the gravity of what we're missing. And through that, to hopefully come to express that through tears. So I want to start with a relatively well-known Gemara that I think most of us know about and we've read and we've learned, but there are some basic questions that I think need to be asked when learning this Gemara. And that is the Gemara that talks about the first Tisha B'Av, the first time that there was a Tisha B'Av, that Tisha B'Av in the calendar was a day of tragedy. And that is, for those of us who know, was the sin of the spies, the sin of the Meraglim. The Gemara in source number one, Masechet Ta'anit, I have it here for you in Hebrew, and we'll read it in Hebrew, but I have the English translation. B'tisha B'Av nigzar al avotenu shelo yukansu la'aretz. That on Tisha B'Av, on the ninth of Av, that was when, the commemoration of when God decreed that the Jewish people would not enter the land of Israel. V'tanya. And then the Gemara goes through and tries to show how we know that it was on Tisha B'Av. Why? Because the Braita says, V'esrim b'tisha b'sivan, on the 29th of Sivan, shalach Moshe meraglim. That's when Moshe sent the Meraglim, and the Gemara has an earlier way of determining that. You'll just have to trust me that the Gemara determines that it was the 29th of Sivan when the Meraglim were sent. And then, Uktiv, the Pasuk says, Vayashuvu mitor haaretz miketz arba'im yom. So we know how many days were they actually spying the land? 40 days. So if you take 29, you add 40 days, says the Gemara, comes out to Tisha B'Av. Ask the Gemara, not really, because, well, it really depends on, was the month of Tammuz 29 days, or was it 30 days? And the Gemara has a whole discussion. And in the end, the Gemara establishes that the month of Tammuz was 30 days. And if you therefore take the 29th of Sivan and a full 30 days of Tammuz, you come to the calculation that Tisha B'Av was the day they returned, and that was the day that it was decreed that they would not enter the land of Israel. Skipping now to the second to last line, Amar Rabba Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Ota Laila Leil Tisha B'Av Haya. That night when it was decreed that when they cried, and when it was decreed that they wouldn't enter the land, that was on Tisha B'Av. Amar lahem HaKadosh Baruch Hu, atem b'chitem b'chiyah shel chinam. You are crying for nothing. Chinam literally means for no good reason. Okay. V'ani koveh lachem b'chiyah l'dorot. And I will establish for you a crying of generations. Now, I just want to take one small pointer that I want to point out. Just, I think, an important point is that it's really a sidebar. What does it mean, b'chiyah shel chinam, a crying for no reason? They were crying for a reason. They were crying for a reason. There was a reason they were crying. They were crying because they didn't want to enter the land of Israel. And in fact, this is a question that I've heard that's very relevant to what we talk about often on Tisha B'Av. We talk about the concept of sinat chinam. Sinat chinam is, right, usually is understood to be baseless hatred. That because we have baseless hatred, that's why the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, and we have to work on that. Now, I remember hearing the following idea from by J.J. Schachter, who's a professor at Yeshiva University and a scholar. He said, what does that mean, baseless hatred? When was the last time any of us really hated somebody for no reason? Right? How often do we go up to somebody and be like, you know, I don't really know you, I know nothing about you, but I hate you. Right? We always have a reason. There's always a reason why we hate somebody. Right? To say that, like, the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed for baseless hatred, what does that mean? So it says by J.J. Schachter, and I think it fits in here, we have to redefine what it means, baseless. Baseless doesn't mean there was no reason. What it means is there was no good reason. Of course we had a reason, right? We have aspects of different people. They bother us. This annoys us about them. Whatever it'll be, we always have a reason. We always have something that we use to justify it. But it wasn't a good reason. And that's what sinat chinam means. Sinat chinam doesn't mean I hate somebody for no reason. It means I hate somebody, but I don't really necessarily, that reason is not necessarily justified. Now, I might justify it. That's the process that we have to go through of understanding when we're doing it in the right and wrong context. The same thing is here. When it says b'chiyah shel chinam, that the Jewish people cried a crying of nothing, it doesn't mean they cried for no reason. It means the reason wasn't justified. And therefore, because of that, God responded by saying, that's it. This night is now going to be set aside as a night of crying. Okay. Now, the Mefarshim on this Gemara asked, where did the Gemara get this from? I mean, there's some kind of hint in the text somewhere to this concept being that because of this crying, there was going to be some kind of continued reverberation. And if you look at source number 2, they point to some psukim in Tehillim, where they say we're in Tehillim, there's already, David HaMelech already connects what happened to continued tragedy. The pasuk is describing Am Yisrael rejecting entering the land. Vayima asu be'eretz chemda, and they, again, I have it translated on the bottom. They rejected this wonderful land, the land that is desired. Lo ha'eminu lidvaro, they didn't believe Hashem's promise. Vayeragnu ba'alehem, and they ran away back into their tents. Lo shamu b'kol Hashem, and they didn't listen to the words of Hashem. Vayisai yado lahem lahapilo tamba bidbar, and God decided at that moment that this generation needed to die in the desert. Ulahapil zaram bagoyim ulizarotam ba'aratzot. And God also decided, and this is the key, God also decided, as it says here in the translation, to disperse their offspring among the nations and scatter them through the lands. Which means that there's already a hint in these psukim that what happened there, what happened in the midbar, the night of when the Jewish people cried because they didn't want to enter the land, that somehow is connected to the eventual Khorban, the eventual galus that we're still experiencing today, although we have the pleasure to be in the land of Israel in a physical sense. So the question that I just wanted to understand here is, what's the connection? Meaning, what exactly is the connection? I would say it this way. Okay, obviously the Jewish people sinned. It was a horrible sin. We could talk from today till tomorrow about the values of Eretz Yisrael and the value of the land of Israel. And it was clear that the Jewish people didn't want it. But number one, what is the connection between that and between Chorban? Why is Tisha B'Av, which is the night that they cried not wanting to enter the land of Israel, how is that connected to the eventual destruction. And why is that the precursor for the eventual destruction? Why did God decide that because of that, this is going to happen, number one? Number two, why is the focus on the crying? Why isn't the focus on the sin? Meaning, where did the sin start? When did the sin start, really, the sin of Viraglim? When they sent the spies. When they sent the spies, that was the beginning of it. Or when the spies came back. Meaning there are many different points at which we could really focus and turn to, that was the moment of sin. And yet what this Gemara doesn't do is focus on that. It focuses specifically on the crying. Why the crying?
It's at the point of the crying that the rejection of the promise is actualized.
What do you mean? Why?
Behaviorally.
Okay. Okay, excellent. Okay, good. So what Sonia's saying, just to repeat it, is that the crying represents an internalization of the sin itself. Okay, meaning until that point, they could have rejected it, they could have been listening, or they might not have rejected it outright, but they might have still been, there was no clear indication, there was a clear indication because people were clearly not listening, but the crying was a monumental moment in this entire process. Because the crying was when they clearly showed, it's very hard to fake cry. Crying represents an internal feeling, a sense. There's something, when a person cries over something, that shows that you have been touched by that event in a positive way or in a negative way. So when the Jewish people, after hearing everything and doing everything, and Yoshua coming and saying, no, it's going to be fine, and Moshe and Aaron, and all that happened, all that was still like, you know, the jury was still out. At what moment was it clear the Jewish people are just not able to enter the land of Israel because they just don't want to go? That was the crying. The crying was the reflection of this internal process, but only meant something when they expressed it through the crying. And I brought for you just a line that I saw quoted a number of places at Rav Hirsch, in a totally different context, talks about what tears. What are tears? So it says Rav Hirsch in verse number 3, tears are the sweat of the working soul. Sweat is the tears of the working body. Meaning what sweat is for the body is what tears are for the soul. It's an expression of something deep. And so therefore when Klal Yisrael cried, that was the moment where they truly expressed, we don't want to go. We really don't want to go. This is not just an external issue. This is something that's deep within us. And by the way, I also saw this written somewhere else. I thought it was fascinating. I'm not usually a big gematria person, right? Gematria in terms of the numbers of the letters. And if you look, but someone I saw pointed out that the gematria of the word lev is 32, and the gematria of bechi. Bechi, which means to cry, bet chaf yud, is also 32. Because when a person cries, it's an expression of their inner selves, of who they are. Again, in a positive way or in a negative way. When we're moved to tears, it's expressing something deep within us. And in fact, the Maharal, in source number 4, this is 2 weeks in a row that we're learning the Maharal. We don't usually learn the Maharal together. But the Maharal says this in a very, very powerful way. He says that there was something incredibly tragic that happened when Am Yisrael cried. The crying was the key. It wasn't the sending of the spies. It wasn't the report of the spies. Those were all just the beginning of it. But something tragic happened the second that Am Yisrael started to cry. Because when they started to cry, they showed, we really don't want to go, which severed whatever type of connection the Jewish people were meant to have with the land of Israel, was severed by that crying. Look at source number 4. We're going to skip the first paragraph and just go to the second paragraph. He's trying to understand, what does this mean that they cried, and because they cried, therefore there's tragedy continuing for generations. The ode says the Maharal, and this is a theme in the Maharal a lot. Kikol hadvarim hativiim, mishtokikim el mikomam hativi. He says that every part of nature, every being in nature, yearns to be in its natural habitat. This is a theme that he discusses all over, by the way, when he talks about Am Yisrael and being in the land of Israel, because he talks about the Jews, when they're in Galut, are not in their natural habitat, and therefore we're not complete, and we're more complete when we're in the land of Israel. And Rav Kook writes about this as well. So says the Maharal, every being wants to be in its natural habitat. Most of us know there's nothing like home. There's nothing like home. There's nothing like getting home, whether it's the home that you grew up in, or it's the home that you're comfortable with. Like, you yearn to have that. We just went away for Shabbos. My family and I just went away for Shabbos. We went to Yerushalayim. We live in Shalavim. We traveled for Shabbos for a few nights. My parents are away now. So we went to their apartment. And my 5-year-old son, the second night, just started crying. Why? What's wrong? He said, I want to go home. I want my bed. He just, he couldn't really express what was wrong, but he wanted to be in his bed. He wanted to be in his natural habitat. We have a 2-year-old, and when we first got to my parents' apartment, he was just walking around, opening up everything, because you could see that he was like not in his normal area, trying to like assimilate where he is. Okay, so that's not just true of 3-year-olds and 2-year-olds and 5-year-olds. It's true of everybody. Everyone wants to be in their natural habitat. We feel pulled towards that natural habitat. Says the Maharal, "V'im haya ha'eretz liYisrael makom tivi." Had the land to Am Yisrael been their natural habitat, and had they been mishtokek, means yearned, had they showed that yearning, which is what it was meant to be, then there would have been a connection that would have been eternal, that would have continued forever. And this is part of a different theme he suggests, where Maral says earlier that if they had gone into the land directly without having to wait, that would have been eternal, and it was, and again, it's a different theme, but it's clear that had Am Yisrael gone in, that would have created that eternal connection. Aval hayakam hefich. What happened? The opposite happened. Shebachu b'chiyah shel chinam. We instead started crying. V'lo ratzu lavo la'aretz. V'lachein morezeh she'ein ha'aretz makom hativi liYisrael. By crying and showing that deep down we don't want to be there, so we severed that connection. The Jewish people were meant to have this connection from Avraham Avinu. We were meant to go. This was supposed to happen. So now that connection, and even though we're going to end up going, it's a totally different relationship. It's a totally different relationship. That eternal connection is on a much lower level. The lekach lo hayuni sharim sham. And by the way, that's also why that generation had to die, because that generation had severed their connection and they couldn't go into the land of Israel. Sorry, let me just find the place. When we say that they cried a crying of nothing, and they threw away this land, or they disgusted this land, and this idea, by severing this connection with the land in a deep way, impacted not just them, but impacted the Jewish people for generations. Shehaya goreim shegalu min ha'aretz. Because that connection is no longer what it was, therefore, that's what's ultimately going to cause the eventual destruction. Ki habichya shehayu bochim moreh she'ein ha'aretz shayach lahem legamrei. Because the fact that they were crying, that showed that deep down, they didn't feel connected to this land in the most intense way. Ki chein makom al yoshveha. V'kol davar mishtokek limkomo shehu tiv'ilo. Because every human being, every being, yearns to be in its natural habitat. And when they got up and said, we don't want to be there, and they cried, which showed that it wasn't just something they were saying, it was something they meant, that severed the connection. Which means, ladies and gentlemen, what we're seeing here is that when we get to the core, what's the history of Tisha B'Av? What is Tisha B'Av all about? At its core, the initial story of Tisha B'Av began with a crying, which resulted in a severing of our connection to the land of Israel in the deepest way it could be. Now, obviously, we went in and we built the Beit HaMikdash and we built another Beit HaMikdash and we're here today. So there's the connection is there, but it's missing something. It's missing something. That bichya that they cried reverberated for generations and caused there to be a certain a lower level of connection with the land that continues until today. Those tears that we cried, those tears the Jewish people cried, impacts us even today. That's what the Gemara means when it says, "Atem bachitem b'chiyah shel chinam, ani akva lachem b'chiyah ledorot." By crying back then and hurting their connection to the land of Israel, that impact created and reverberated for years. Yes, Simon.
It doesn't seem that kavua aspect is talking about Tisha B'Av. It's talking about the Chiyah. No reference to the day.
What do you mean?
That quote, "You cried, I'll make a permanent."
Are you saying it doesn't say there that it's going to be on that day? Meaning you're right. The words "aniyek balachem b'chialedo" wrote don't necessarily. The understanding is understood to be, and it's a good point. It doesn't say today is going to be that day, but the understanding is going to be this day is going to be set aside for continued crying. Even though it doesn't, meaning, aniyek balachem b'chiyah ledorot means, at least the way that it's standardly understood, standardly, if that's a word.
Does that contradict the promise of Hashem has in the Torah that I will not punish you for the sins of the
Torah? Ah, okay, so you're raising an excellent question. Okay? Simon is saying, wait a second, how can we ever be punished for the sins of our, isn't the story say that we're not punished for the sins of our grandparents and grandparents or in earlier generations? Okay, I don't want to get too off topic on this. You have an answer for that, Sonia?
I learned somewhere, I don't remember where, that there's a difference between individual sins and national.
Okay, good. So Sonia's pointing out there could be a difference between national and individual. I don't know. I think the simplest understanding, and again, without getting into too much of the theology of it, because it's a great question and it's a longer question. I think you have to differentiate between being punished for their sins and dealing with the reality that results from their sins. Okay? Meaning, there's no question that my life is different based on the actions that my parents and grandparents and great-grandparents took. Now, is that me being punished for their sins, or is that just the reality of what happened? So I that's how I understand this here. It's not that, let's say, every single generation we're being punished again. It's not like, you know, original sin in Christianity, which I don't fully understand, so I don't want to get... But it's much more about there's results. Our actions have results. Our actions impact our children and our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren. The same thing is here. That once that happened, it's not like we're being just eternally punished for it. It's more that this is the reality that we have now. Our world shifted. Our relationship as a nation shifted. And that impacts the future generations. But we're going to see, as we're going to see, that doesn't mean we don't have the ability to hopefully fix it. And that's part of what Tisha B'Av is meant to be. Okay, so what we've seen so far is just simply that, at least at its core, the initial Tisha B'Av was a day of tears, was defined by crying. The crying was the crux of the sin, and it was the crux of what then continued to develop, or what God used to say, this is going to continue. It doesn't say I'm going to punish you for generations. He says, I'm going to make you cry. There's going to be lots of crying happening as a result of this sin. And as the Maharal says, it's because the crying wasn't just crying to be sad. The crying impacted and had an effect on our relationship with Eretz Yisrael. And we'll get to this soon. But if we think about it, if the crying is what severed our connection, then when we talk about rebuilding our connection and we talk about what we're trying to do on Tisha B'Av, which we'll get to in a little bit, then the key is going to be tears and crying or trying to get into those emotions as much as we can. But we'll get to that soon. That's just the history. That's the story in the Chet HaMoradim. Yes, please.
But surely the fact that we are here now, it must mean something. I mean, crying, yes, but maybe we've been forgiven.
Because we're back here now. Okay, so you're raising I think a great question, which is basically, again, I'll refer to it because I think it's an important question that comes up often when we talk about Tisha B'Av. I think this is what you're referring to, how far you would take it. But there are people that ask the question, which is, should we really be mourning on Tisha B'Av? How much should we be mourning on Tisha B'Av? Is that kind of what you're asking? Meaning, does the fact that we're here and we're, you know, despite whatever internal challenges we're creating for ourselves, we're, you know, a thriving country and a beautiful, you know, walk down the streets of Yerushalayim and you know, things are really, if you take a step back, things are pretty good here. So then how much should we be mourning? Which is, I think, what you're asking. And that's a very good question, and that's really a question that is subject to a big debate in the religious world. What I've gotten from my father, from my Rebbeim, and I believe it, which is that we're not going to necessarily take away from what's happened, but there's so much more that there isn't. We may not fully appreciate what it is. We'll talk about that a little bit soon. But the fact that, true, we've come very far, and God has allowed us to return back to the land, and there's been clear miracles, and there's clear movement happening, but there's so much more that we haven't. The fact that there's no Beit HaMikdash, and the fact that we aren't able to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the complete way, still requires us, and still demands of us, and to mourn, and to recognize what's missing. Mourning doesn't mean we're going to ignore what's happening, right? Mourning just means you're focusing on something else. You're recognizing that there's still something fundamental, major, that's missing. That's life changing, and that as far as we've come, we have that much more to go, and that's what Tisha B'Av is still about. And that's what I was saying. Even though they did enter the land at the end of the day, and even though they built the Beit HaMikdash, at least according to the Maharal, that connection had been shifted dramatically. Right? You could say the same thing. What happened when they built the Beit HaMikdash? Had they been forgiven? Well, there was a destruction, and then there was meaning. We don't know. Have we entered a point where things can't go back if we don't deserve it? But there are some people that will say, no, we're already in the times of the redemption. Redemption has begun. This is a huge debate in the Orthodox, in the religious Zionist world. You know, are we in the times of redemption or not? My understanding, when I've gotten from my Rebbe and my father and my Rebbe, specifically Rav Lichtenstein, is that we're in times of tremendous opportunity. Are they times of redemption? Maybe. We hope so. But that's up to us. And therefore, and are we at a point of no return where nothing can be good? Meaning, we're not there. We have not received redemption until the building of the third Beit HaMikdash, until Mashiach comes, until we're at a point where things are at the point that they need to be. We're still missing, and that's what we need to be mourning, even on Tisha B'Av.
The stages, you're talking about the ultimate...
Correct.
Absolutely.
We hope.
It doesn't come.
Correct. There's a big debate about how that's going to come, but correct. The simple understanding, exactly. Correct. But it's important to note, stages can sometimes also take steps back. Stages can sometimes be, meaning, again, I don't want to get into this debate too much, but it's an important debate, and it's an important discussion, and it's a great conversation. But at the same time, I think what we're talking about is we're still missing something. And that's clear. And we might not even really appreciate what we're missing. We don't really understand it. But that's part of, I think, what we're mourning about and crying about on Tisha B'Av. Okay, so now after we talked about the sin of the Meraglim, now getting to the actual story of the destruction itself. Okay, if you look at Megillas Eichad a number of times, we're not going to go through all the different psukim. The theme of crying is there throughout. Bachotiv keba laila. It's the second pasuk in Eicha. Okay, and Rashi says, what does it mean? Bachotiv ke. Bachotiv ke is double language. Shtei bichiot al shtei chorbanot. We're crying twice for the double destruction. Okay? You keep going, Al Eila Ani Bochia, the famous lines, on this I am crying, right? If you look throughout Megillat Eicha, the theme of crying, of tears, is there throughout. Perek Bet, Kalu Bidmaot Enaicha Marmor, meaning my tears are done because I have nothing left. Nishbach La'aretz Kvedi Al Shever Bat Ami. Everything has been thrown to the ground, meaning my tears have spilled to the ground because of the break of what's happened to my nation. Okay, Perek Gimel, Palgei Mayim Tered Eini. Tons of tears are flowing from my eyes. We see that throughout Eicha, this theme of crying, this theme of tears is predominantly there throughout. And the truth is that not only is the theme of crying there throughout, according to certain Mefarshim, according to certain commentaries, when Yirmiyahu wrote Eicha, he did that with tears. What do I mean? Look at this fascinating. There's a fascinating discussion that comes out of a relatively well known halacha. If you look at source number 6, the Rambam. Rambam talks about when a person can achieve prophecy, and says the Rambam, Kol hanivim ein mitnabim bechol eich yirtu. Nivua, prophecy wasn't able to happen whenever people wanted. Ela michavnim datam v'yoshvim. What happened was, says the Rambam, this is the Rambam's approach to Nivua. Rambam's approach to prophecy was that it wasn't like I was walking on the street if I was a Navi and all of a sudden, boom, I got a prophecy. I had to sit there and I had to work on it. I had to meditate. I had to get into a certain mindset. V'yoshvim, they sit there, smechim v'tovei lev. They would sit there happy, content, umit bodidim. They would concentrate. They would do meditation. She'en nevu'a shorah lo mitoch atzvut. Because prophecy will never come from sadness or from laziness. It will only come from happiness. Based on this, one of the Mefarshim to the Rambam, a parish called the Yad HaMelech, which is Rabbi Eliezer Landau, was the grandson of the Noda Yehuda, he asked a question. He says, wait a second. Is every prophecy that we have always done with happiness? Are there prophecies that we have where there was some sadness? Of course. What's the most fundamental prophecy that we have that was created with tears? Eicha. So he says, how is that possible? What about this Rambam? The Rambam just said, you can't have nevuah prophecy without happiness. Well, then how did Yirmiyahu write? How did he write Megillat Eicha? So look at source number 7. V'nei gam shematzinu l'nevi'im ha-kedoshim shehidnavu b'shivron lev uv'itzvon ruach. Even though we have found in certain places where prophets would bring a nevuah, prophecy about with sadness and with brokenheartedness and talk about the punishments, right? There's nothing worse, there's nothing sadder than, by the way, the way the most Chazal usually refer to Megillat Eicha is not Megillat Eicha, they refer to it as Megillat Kinot. The Megillah of Kinod, Megillah of Lament, Kinod literally is hard to translate, but meaning that, which means that Eicha and the Kinod are really the similar idea. They're all about trying to bring out within us a certain emotion. So yet, Yirmiyahu, he clearly did that when he wasn't happy. I don't think he was happy as he was watching. It's clear from what he's writing that he's very sad. Then how did he achieve prophecy? Says the Yad HaMelech something very, very fundamental. Amnam, tochen ha'inyanim b'tam ha'dvarim. He says, what's the understanding? Who? Devadai ha'arot ruach mimarom ki ruach ha'kodesh shenivuah ru'uya shelo tiye shorah rak al nefesh shlema b'liches ron klal. He says, in order to really understand this, we have to take a step back. When does prophecy come? Prophecy comes when a person achieves a certain sense of completeness. When a person is in a sense of he is able to achieve an emotion in a whole way. Usually, says the Yad HaMelech, that's going to happen through happiness. But sometimes prophets are able to tap into that mentality, even through sadness, but only when it's a sadness that's not for their personal sadness. It's a communal and national sadness. She says, "B'chdei shetehei mukhsheret lekabel koach shalem kaze." Hine kol ze shayach be'itzvon habalo le'adam achmat atzmo. If a person is just sad for himself, then he can't achieve the level needed for prophecy. Ma she'en kein nivim hakidoshim, kishen nivu pur'anutan shel Yisrael, af kilibam hayan ne'enach mitzad sarot Yisrael. Even though they were sad, were they personally sad? Of course Yirmiyahu was personally sad. But he wasn't sad for his own personal challenges. What was he sad for? The national calamity that was happening. Av ki gam alehem avar lachatz hatzarot vatlot. Of course, he was affected by everything, asher avru al kla Yisrael. B'kol zort, hayu modim umivarchim laborei baruch hu usmechim betzedek mishpatav v'yosher dino, v'lo hayu magishim shel atzmam shum tza'ar prati. Meaning, they were fine with whatever challenges was impacting him personally, that he wasn't upset at God about. That he was shalim with Hashem about. What was he angry or sad or upset about? The pain that was being given to Am Yisrael. V'libam haya shalem be'et nivuatam betachlit hashleimut hayoter nechona lenuah. V'ha'itzavon, this is the key, asher haya lahem mitzarot achehem klal Yisrael, ze lo haya mitzad chesron atzmi. L'fikach lo haya itzavon ze monea ruach nivuah shalem. He says, therefore, the fact that this type of sadness was not going to prevent nivuah from happening, because it was done in a way where his sadness was purely communal. It was totally sad for Am Yisrael in general. He was sad for what was going on. And that type of sadness is the type of sadness that a person can still achieve a level of prophecy. So what comes out from this, and I don't want to get hung up on the details, is that according to this understanding, not only does Eicha have within it discussions of crying and tears. Eicha was written in tears. Eicha was written in this. So we have this tradition that the tears were the key to Tisha B'Av. We then enter the world, and we're not talking about the actual destruction, and Yirmiyahu prophesying about that destruction, and he's doing so with tears. He's doing so with tears in his eyes. He's crying. He's sad as this entire thing is happening. And so what we see is that it's clear that this tradition of what caused the destruction is expressed through this cry. Which means then, if we want to then understand how we can rebuild it, as we've talked about, that key is going to be through tears as well. And it starts, I think, with source number 8. Source number 8 is a well-known psukim from Yirmiyahu describing a conversation. And again, there's many midrashim on this, but this is the famous crying of Rachel Imenu to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Because according to Chazal, when did Rachel cry this out? When Am Yisrael were on their way out of Yerushalayim. When they were on their way out of Yerushalayim, according to the Medrash, everyone started going to Hashem, how could you do this? How could you do this? And Hashem didn't listen. And all of a sudden comes Rachel, and she cries to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and Hashem says, okay, they're going to come back. So crying wasn't just the cause of what's happening. Crying is also the way through which the redemption is promised to them, and through which the redemption will ultimately come. Ko amar Hashem, kol b'rama nishma, nihi b'chisam rim, Rachel mevakal baneha. Right? Kol b'rama nishma, kol, a voice is heard, nihi b'chisam rim, Rachel, right? We hear the bitter crying. Rachel is crying about her sons. Me ana lehinachem. She refuses to be comforted. Al baneha ki enenu. And what's God's response to that crying? Ko amar Hashem, mini kolech mi bechi, ve'enayich min dima. Hold your voice back from crying and your eyes from tears. I think this is very, by the way, one of the reasons I think this is such a beautiful few lines is, the Kadosh Baruch Hu could have just said, stop crying. But what does he say? He says, don't cry, wipe your tears. It reminds me of like a parent going up to a child and not just telling them to stop crying, but also going and actively wiping away their tears. HaKadosh Baruch Hu was saying, don't worry. HaKadosh Baruch Hu was like coming as a parent and saying, don't worry, calm down, wipe away your tears. Yesachar lepulatech. There is reward for what you've done. Vishavu be'eretz oyev. They're going to return. They're going to return. V'yesh tikva la'achriteich nu'um Hashem v'shavu banim l'gvulam. And so the key to our return, the key to the promise of our return, also comes from Rachel's cries. The crying of Rachel, that the crying of Rachel coming and saying, how could you do this to my children? That inner just turmoil that she was in, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu responds to and says, Okay. Now, there's different interpretations as to why Hashem specifically listened to Rachel, not to the other Avot. And there's a lot to talk about why it was specifically Rachel. Was it the different thing what she had done for Leah? There's different midrashim. But I would also suggest that it wasn't just what she had done. It was the crying. It was the clear anguish that Rachel showed. Not necessarily that the others didn't. I don't know. But here you see the anguish that she's showing. And that is part of what brought God to say, okay, it's time for me to at least promise you that the Galus will come to an end, and the Geula will ultimately come. And so what we've seen here so far, ladies and gentlemen, is just that the history of Tisha B'Av is shrouded in tears and crying. And I think once we see that, then the key to our ability to then hopefully shift things in the other direction is going to be also through our ability to bring ourselves to tears, to cry, to mourn in the proper way. Now, there's two ways that we do this. One is the way that we do it throughout the year, and the other way is how we do it on Tisha B'Av. The first thing we have to realize is that, and according to Chazal, and we see this in a few sources, is that throughout the year there's this idea of mourning the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash and having that internal pain and despair. Now, it's hard for us to connect to it. We're going to talk about that in a second, but it's there. If you look at source, this is a Shulchan Aruch, the very, very first siman of the Shulchan Aruch, a halacha book, talk about how we're supposed to act. Says the Shulchan Aruch, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, Yosef Cairo, Ra'uy l'kol yirei shamayim. Anyone who fears heaven, sheyehei meitzar v'do'eg al churban Beit HaMikdash. He should be sad and worried about the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. He doesn't just say, by the way, that he should be mit'abel. Meitzar v'do'eg are very, very evocative terms in terms of like, Meitzar means like upset and do'eg, worried. He's saying something more than just check off a box. He's saying we should really be internally feeling it. Now there's a fascinating Gemara that seems to indicate, or at least based on the way that the Maharal understands it, that this is something that's happening internally within us, whether we realize it or not. Look at this wonderful Gemara. The Gemara says in source number 11, sorry, it seems like I made a mistake here with the numbers. The pasuk says, "If you will not hear it, my soul shall weep in secret for your pride." Amar Rav Shmuel bar Inya Mishmei Durav, Makom Yesh Lo LaKadosh Baruch Hu. There is a place that God has. Ushmo Mistarim. Its name is Mistarim. Literally, Mistarim means hidden. We'll get to that in a second. And that's the place. Umay Mipnei Geva. What does it mean? Because of pride. God is crying because the pride that Am Yisrael used to have was now given to the other nations. Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmeni Amar Mipnei Ga'avata Shemachut Shamayim, that it was because of the pride of heaven. Now asks the Gemara a very interesting question. Does God actually cry? Is there such a thing as God crying? V'ha Amar Rav Papa, we have another line in a different place. Ein atzivut lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. There's no such thing as sadness in front of God. Shneimar hod vehadar lifanav, oz vechedva bimkamo. This is in Tehillim. Hod vehadar lifanav, meaning wonder and majesty is in front of Him, and one glory and happiness is in His place. Meaning God is happy inherently. Again, our understanding of God. So where is this bichya? Where does crying come in? Answers the Gemara: Ha lo kashya, ha bevate geivai, ha bevate beirai. One is internal, one is external. Externally, God always shows happiness. But sometimes God internally is crying, even though He doesn't show it. And then the Gemara says, and then the Gemara, well, we won't do it now. The Gemara goes on to even say that there are some moments where God will cry even externally. When? For the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. Now, this is what we would call an agadita Gemara. And we don't really know exactly what it is. What does it mean that God cries? What does it mean that God cries internally? What does it mean that God cries externally? The Maharal asks these questions in source number 12. And I want to just I'll say some of it outside and try to understand. But he gives a very beautiful explanation that I think is relevant for us for today. The Maharal says, what does this mean? What does it mean that God cries? In what way does God cry? And he explains that when we talk about the actions of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it always has to do in relation to the person. Our understanding of God's actions is always related to the person or the object that God is relating to. So when we talk about God crying, if you look at this, is the last line of source number of the first paragraph of source number 12, Ka'asher ha-mikabel. We're the ones who are receiving from God, meaning we're the ones interacting with God. Shehem Yisrael, yesh lahem churban Beit HaMikdash. When we are the ones who are mourning, who deal with the Churban Beit HaMikdash, are the ones interacting with God, That's when God will show, express himself in crying. And says the Maharal, what does it mean that God cries in this place called Mistarim? What it means is, Mistarim isn't this place that God hides. Mistarim means the inside of every single person. Because inside every single Jewish person is a spark of God, is an expression of God. And in that part, what does it mean that God cries towards the inside, not towards the outside? What it means is that every single Jew, that neshama, that spark inside, is eternally crying for the lack of a Beit HaMikdash. We don't know it. We might not be attuned to it. We might not be fully aware. That's what it means when it says that God cries internally, not externally. Because externally, we're in touch with whatever part of what we're in touch with, and we're walking around, and everything is great. But there's a spark within us, i.e. the part, our neshama, our soul, that comes from God, that is eternally crying at the lack of the Beit HaMikdash, at the mourning for the Beit HaMikdash. And that's continuous until the Beit HaMikdash will be rebuilt. And even though we don't really fully understand it, it's there. It's, you know, very often we talk about how sometimes you have stories where people come back to Judaism after, and we talk about what's called the Pintele Yid, right? That little spark. What brought them back? What was it? Each of us have that spark. Each of us have that spark, and says the Maharal, based on this Gemara, that spark within us, that godliness within us, is crying at the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. We might not be attuned to it. We might not be fully aware of what's going on, but it's there. And so crying was the history, and crying is something that internally we are doing on a daily basis. It's not expected of us to do it externally, meaning it's important to note. The halacha doesn't say up above we should be crying every single day and we should be bringing it out. We don't necessarily have to be expressing it every single day, but we should know that deep down there's a part of us that yearns for the Beit HaMikdash and for that connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And I think this, just to kind of highlight this point, in the introduction to the Art School keynote, he quotes a beautiful mashal, beautiful parable to highlight this point. The Hasidic master of Buna of Pshischa, this is source number 13, illustrated this concept with the parable of a king who amassed tremendous treasures and hid them in a secret storage room deep inside the palace. One day the palace caught fire and burned down to the ground. The entire nation and royal court cried over the loss of the beautiful palace, but the king cried more bitterly than any of them, for he alone knew the extent of the loss. Only he knew of the enormous hidden treasure that went up in smoke as well. Similarly, a person who is out of touch with his inner soul, which is, I would say, venture to say, most if not all of us, hardly appreciates the spiritual loss suffered with the temple's destruction. And therefore, it's there, but we're not fully in touch. So what we're highlighting here is that, according to Chazal, we might not realize it, but there's an internal anguish that we experience throughout the year. But then there's one day of the year where we're supposed to take that internal anguish and express it in a more external way. And that's Tisha B'Av. So let's turn now, please, to source number, we'll skip 14 for now. Source number 15. Source number 15 is, now we're going to get to what we talk about. What's the Avodat Hayom? What's the Avodah? What are we supposed to be doing on Tisha B'Av? And Rav Soloveitchik, in beautiful language, and with your permission, I'll read it, even though it's a little bit long, he highlights the fact that fundamentally, he calls it, what Tisha B'Av is a day of Yom HaKinah. Yom HaKinah, not Kinah as in jealousy, but a day of keynote. A day. Now, what is Yom HaKinah? What are the keynote meant to do? They're meant to create that sense of sadness. When we sit there all day reading Eicha and reading the keynote, the purpose of it is to elicit emotion, is to elicit those tears. Now, I'm going to obviously throw out there, and I'm going to make it clear, just to be clear, this isn't easy. I mean, no one should feel that if they're not able to start crying about Beit HaMikdash in a few days, that they've missed something. It's the process. We should be yearning for it and understanding it, even if we can't achieve the level that we want to. Because that process itself obviously has an effect on us. Look at source number 15, Rav Soloveitchik, beautifully and in halachic terms. This is what's so beautiful and unique about Rav Soloveitchik is everything we've been discussing until now was more in the hashkafa, the world of machshava, thought. And the Rav was great at taking that and bringing it into the world of halacha. There is no kedushat hayom, no intrinsic sanctity on Tisha B'Av, but it is nevertheless a red-letter day in our calendar. Tisha B'Av is intrinsically invested with special significance, and the mitzvah of the day is keynote. We know this from the Haftorah. The Haftorah says, "Some in the dirge sinners, let them come, that our eyes may run with tears." Of course, and just by way of introduction, the Rav, and we mentioned this before, Soloveitchik is going to contrast two different types of mourning. Mourning is an M-O-U, avilut, that exists in Jewish thought. One is called, we've mentioned this in past years, one is called avilut chadasha, and the other is called avilut yishana. Avilut chadasha refers to new mourning. that a person, which is the mourning that results when a person suffers a loss of a relative. And that's called Avelut Chadasha because it's new. It's something that just happens. It's fresh. It's just new. Avelut Yishana is a reference to the mourning that we do over the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash because it's old. It happened thousands and thousands of years ago. And he's been, in many different ways, Rav Soloveitchik compares and contrasts the way we act or the halachot of Avelut Chadasha that we're supposed to have in our personal Avelut that we have when we suffer a loss, and the communal Avelut Yishana that we commemorate on Tisha B'Av. And he's going to do that right now. Of course, in the case of Avelut Chadasha that we have for personal mourning, there's what's called 3 days to cry and 7 days to eulogize. That's what's known as the Shiva. We have a reference to the shedding of tears, but I do not believe that this is the major symbol of Avelut Chadasha. The core of Avelut Chadasha is tearing one's clothes, turning one's bed over when that practice was observed. We don't observe that nowadays, and so forth and so on. But not keynote. There's no idea of saying keynote or drawing up keynote about the person that passed away. There's no idea that you have to sit there and evoke certain emotions. We're going to see why in a second. But he says it doesn't exist by Avelut Chadasha. Contrast that with Tisha B'Av, where the recital of Kiddush is absolutely central as the fundamental instrument we use to employ or manifest our mourning. Tisha B'Av without Kiddush is an incomplete Avelut. Sorry for some of the typos. The Kiyum, or fulfillment of the obligation of Avelut on Tisha B'Av, would simply not be achieved. Crying or shedding tears is central to Avelut Yishana. Now, I'm skipping here a little bit in the actual book, but Kina, just continuing now, the third paragraph. Kina is a specific fulfillment of the Avelut characteristic of Tisha B'Av. Kina expresses itself in the fact that our emotional reaction is very important. Kina simply is the sense of crying. When the famous letter was sent to Zechariah the prophet by the Bnei HaGolah, asking whether they had to observe Tisha B'Av while the second Beit HaMikdash was being rebuilt. There was a moment when they observed Tisha B'Av and the destruction in between the first and second. And then the question became, when the second Beit HaMikdash was rebuilt, should we still observe Tisha B'Av? Says Soloveitchik, how did they ask it? What language did they use to express and ask about their observance? They formulated the question as, shall I cry on the fifth month? They didn't ask, shall I mourn on the fifth month? Which means that their way of describing how they observed Tisha B'Av was crying. Crying is definitional to the day of Tisha B'Av. When it comes to Avelut Chadasha, God forbid, we mourn. But there is no halachic obligation to cry. The Avelut of a mourner is a natural Avelut. It is spontaneous. If a member of the family is taken away, everyone reacts emotionally with crying. We do not have to instruct or teach the mourning how to mourn, the mourners how to mourn or how to weep. A mourner does not have to say keynote, right? When it comes to Avelut Chadasha, there's a visceral emotional reaction that is automatic, and everyone does it differently. And therefore, there's no command, you have to cry for a personal Avelut. Whatever emotion comes out, that's what comes out, and that's the natural reaction. However, when it comes to Avelut Yishana, it's different. Contrast this to Avelut Yishana of Tisha B'Av for Churban Yerushalayim. It is an old Avelut. We mourn for something that happened more than 1900 years ago. With Avelut Yishana, there is no spontaneous reaction. The lack of a Beit HaMikdash in all these years has become normal for us. There is always an equation between reality and normality. Whatever is real is normal, and whatever is normal is real. People do not look upon reality as abnormal. And so, the Avelut is much harder. There is more than a risk. There is a natural reality that over time, people will forget. Thus, the mourning of Tisha B'Av has to be taught. One must understand it thoroughly and be sensitive to it. We must learn how to mourn, to wail and weep for the Churban Beit HaMikdash. This is exactly the mitzvah of Avelut Yishana, to respond by crying. And so Soloveitchik, in halachic terms, in a beautiful way, explains that what we're trying to do on Tisha B'Av, the purpose of the keynote is not just to just read them. The purpose of the keynote is to help us understand what we're missing, is to evoke a certain reaction, to evoke a certain inner reaction to this reality that we have around us. And he says, as opposed to normal Avelut, where that will happen naturally, when it comes to Tisha B'Av, we have to bring it out. And that's what the keynote is about. That's what Tisha B'Av is about. It's about when we sit down and we sit with what's happening. We don't justify it. We don't yet help ourselves feel better about it. We don't comfort ourselves. That'll happen after. Happens a little bit towards the end of Tisha B'Av. That it happens at Shabbat Nachamu. That'll happen later. Now, we just sit with the reality. We wallow in it. And we try to evoke this kind of a certain reaction that maybe isn't as natural as we would want it to be. Now again, I want to stress, this is very, very hard level to get to. And many of us have trouble with it. Which is why, what do many people do? They avoid it. Right? It's much easier to avoid something than to sit with it. To sit with it. It's much easier to just, you know, let the day go by with other things to keep ourselves busy than to actually sit and try to understand it. And that's what we need to be trying to do. Our vodah on Tisha B'Av is to sit there and to try to evoke that emotion. Because just like, again, getting back, and then we'll end in 2 minutes. Just like we saw that what severed that connection to the land was ultimately that internal emotional crying that Am Yisrael did. That was what brought about this severance in the connection to the land of Israel. I believe the easiest way to understand it is to recognize that the best way to reconnect us to the land of Israel and to reconnect ourselves to our national history and destiny is to evoke that same emotion about the destruction and to show that internally, deep down, that's what we want. We want that. Ultimately, we all know that. We always say that. You know, part of what this is a test of what we want. We really want it. People ask us sometimes, do we really want the Beit HaMikdash? We say those words. We want the Beit HaMikdash. We sing Ani Ma'amin Be'emunah Shleimah. Do we really want it? The best way to show that is if we're able to evoke that emotion within us through understanding, through educating ourselves. As Rosh Halevitchik says, it needs to be taught. It's not going to happen automatically. It needs to be worked on. It needs to be developed. And we have a few days now to develop it. I just want to end with one final thought, which is that when we talk about crying, we have to recognize... No, this is Rosh Halevitchik. It's a Sefer in England. Many, many Svarim have come out over the years in English. On different things. This was in English. It's, I think I had the title here, The Lord is Righteous in All His Ways. It was written in English and edited, put out by like Mesoras Harav, which is the foundation that has been putting out a lot of his books. So it wasn't stuff that he put out himself when he was alive, but posthumously was put out. Crying, we talked about crying and crying and evoking a certain reaction. But crying, we have to recognize, is crying doesn't just... act as a way to express our emotions. It also, in a certain way, has a very comforting piece to it, right? Very often, somebody's going through something, and it's painful, and it's painful, and it's painful, and then sometimes they're able to cry it out. How do they feel afterwards often? A certain relief. A certain relief, a certain sense of... Now, what's that relief from? Is that anything change? No. But when you're able to express it, there's something emotional that comes out from that. And so what I would end with is that the crying isn't just about being sad and the emotion of sadness, it's also part of what's going to bring us that comfort. Because when we're able to cry in a way that meaningful, sometimes that healthy, right? As the phrase goes, I just needed a good cry, right? Why? Because when you have that ability to cry, sometimes that's what is able to help also give you the beginning of that sense of comfort, of that sense of, okay, I can move in that certain direction. And with that, I wanted to just quote this well-known Gemara, source number 17. Kol hamitabel al Yerushalayim zoche v'ro'e b'simchata. Anyone who mourns on Yerushalayim merits and sees its happiness. Now, the question that everyone points out is, it's not what we think it should be saying. What it should be saying is, anyone who mourns about Yerushalayim will merit yizke v'yir'e b'simchata, will get to merit it's being rebuilt. That's the way it's standardly understood, that if we mourn, we'll merit to see it. But it actually says, Zochev Roeh is in the present, which means that when you're mourning, the simple understanding of it is, you're starting already to be able to see the simcha. The mourning itself, the act of mourning, the act of crying, going through that process, is already step one to the revival, to the rebuilding. Because the fact that we're doing it, the fact that we're going through it, the fact that we're going through this process is itself step one to feeling that level of redemption, which we hope will come. And that's the beginning of the nechama. The nechama, when we get to Shabbos Nachamu, is this ability, which we're not there yet. We'll get there, Be'ezrat Hashem. But and I saw that Rabbi Yitzchak Levi Berditchev, the Hasidic master, suggests that the zoche literally means to merit. But another way of using that word in the Hasidic style, it can be zochek, can also mean lehizdakech, means to purify. It means to cleanse oneself. And the idea could be that when a person is able to really be mit'abel and cry, there's a cleansing process that happens through that. There's a cleansing that a person goes through when they're able to connect to that in a deep way, that then cleanses them and gives them koach to then continue and really work towards the rebuilding. So what we saw today was a little bit jumping around, and I apologize for that. But what I wanted to highlight today was, I think that there's a, you know, as preparing for Tisha B'Av, the theme of tears. The theme of tears, the theme of crying, is something that is everywhere. Wherever you go and you look at Tisha B'Av, whether it's the initial history of Tisha B'Av, the first Tisha B'Av, the crying of the Meraglim, or the crying of Am Yisrael, which represented their internalization of a lack of desire to enter the land, and caused that, as the Maharal says, this disconnect between them and the land. And then we have, even during the time of the actual destruction, as Megillat Eicha, which highlights crying all over, as it's being written according to the Yad HaMelech and according to this explanation of the Rambam, it was written with tears, it was written with sadness, it was written with these tears. These tears are part and parcel of the history of Tisha B'Av. And then, as we said, if that's what the history is all about, and the cause of it is the crying, then the ultimate redemption is ultimately going to come only through that crying. Beginning with Rachel Imenu's crying, when she first indicates that crying to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and God says, okay, there will be a redemption. It's going to happen. I'm not going to tell you when, but it will happen. Continue with our eternal crying internally in our neshama throughout, even if we're not fully in touch with it. It's there continuously on an everyday basis. And we're supposed to tap into that through various things that we do by commemorating the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. To Tisha B'Av, or one day a year, we're meant to take that internal crying that's going on and try to bring it out. Try to tap into that piece of us that does understand and connect to the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. And we try to envelop ourselves with that on Tisha B'Av. And that's what the keynote do. Tisha B'Av is a Yom HaKinah. Yom HaKinah, a day of crying, a day of tears, and that's expressed through the keynote. And as we've just closed with, and the hope is that in through that we're not just tapping into the mourning, but we're also beginning to feel the process of redemption through that process of crying, which can cleanse us and hopefully bring us towards the final redemption, Bezrat Hashem. Everyone should have a meaningful and an easy fast, and we'll continue with Parsha next week, Bezrat Hashem.